Luxicult is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
What is there to believe in but self? And self is the negation of completeness as reality. No man has seen self at any time. We are what we believe and what it implies by a process of time in the conception. Creation is caused by this bondage to formula. Actions are the expressions of ideas bound up in belief. They, being inherent, are obscure, their operations indirect. Easily they deceive introspection. Fruits of action are twofold, heaven or hell. There are unity or nothingness, purgatory or indifference. In heaven, there is desire for women. In hell, the desire intense. Purgatory is expectation delayed, indifference but disappointment till recovery. Then verily, they are one and the same. The wise pleasure seeker, having realized that they are different degrees of desire and never desirable, gives up both virtue and vice and becomes a quayist. Riding the shark of his desire, he crosses the ocean of dual principle and engages himself in self-love. That is Austin Osman Spare. Hello and welcome to Lux Occult. This is the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult topics, exploring the intersections of magic, art, science, philosophy, technology, and so much more. It's occultism for everyone. I'm your host, Lux Estrada, and if you're hearing the sound of my voice, that means that this show, and magic for that matter, are for you if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice in your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anybody but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree sometimes. How would we ever learn anything if we were all in agreement on all things at all times? And like those who attempt to be reasonable should be willing to do, I am always willing to revise my opinions based on new evidence. So I'm very pleased to be sharing a couple of great conversations with you all today. I spoke with Jeffrey Groves and scratched the surface about some of the many irons he has in the fire, creatively and magically. Both of my guests today are super talented people. So Jeffrey shares about working with the Picatrix and using planetary elections to make talismanic jewelry, and the process and rationale that Z uses there. There's a lot of thought put into what's made on the sorceress workbench, and we get into talking about some classics in that regard. Jeffrey goes into how, in the traditional way of thinking about it, working with the god Dionysus through worship and dance or drink and things like that, one becomes possessed by the god. And we talk about modern Dionysiac worship as well a bit and get into a little bit about how Jeffrey contextualizes that in Ziz's own work. So later on, Jeffrey will share some of the exploits of the Kansas City Pagan Arts Collective and some thoughts and advice about conducting public ritual, some of which I've already had the opportunity to use, so I really appreciate that. It's a great conversation, and there's a lot of practical advice, so stoked to share that. So for the episode within the episode, I sat down with Guillermo, aka Art Worldbuilding, host of the Great Game podcast, for a very heady conversation about identity and the touchstones that we use when trying to wrap our arms around it. Who are you, and what are you up to? There are legions of devils hiding in the details when we begin to meditate on these seemingly simple questions. Art shares a 7-step protocol for approaching games of any type, like in the game theory sense, as well as a great reading list for folks to check out, which will be available in the show notes. As part of this conversation, I happened upon some very fun intersections that some of my recent work has been encountering with that of my new dead boyfriend, Baruch Spinoza. I think what I'll probably do is share a clip from the new album I've been working on that sort of illustrates what I'm talking about here. We'll also hear a few pieces from the Cryptography Poetry Contest that is posted on the Lux Occult Instagram feed. If you like pinup style photography, glamour magic stuff, solving simple cryptographic puzzles, and writing silly poetry for prizes, don't be shy. We will be playing until the end of August, the year of Our Lady 2023, and the winners, who will receive cool swag from my Etsy store and more, will be announced in October, just in time for spooky season proper. Alright, fuck yeah. Before we get into all this good shit, I'd like to say thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you taking the time to hang out with me and my dope guests here on this show. I feel incredibly lucky and very, very grateful to have such top-tier listeners, collaborators, co-conspirators, etc. You can send thoughts, questions, comments, suggestions, or arcane revelations for the listener mail segment to luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at luxoccultpod. If you like the show and you're into what we've got going on here, you can support it on Patreon. If you do so, you can take a bibliomancy break with me, and there are no tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. Buy Me a Coffee is also an option for those who don't want to do the whole Patreon thing. Thank you so much to those of you who are already doing so. The show is quite a lot of work for one tenacious podcaster to produce, but making it means a lot to me, and your support is what makes that possible. So I appreciate it. Thank you. All right, so let me introduce my first guest to you here. This is from jsgroves.com. A human with perhaps too many passions, J.S. Groves has been writing only slightly longer than Z has been practicing witchcraft. A bench jeweler by day, Z has a degree in classical studies and a passion for photography. Z lives in Kansas City with their partner and their feline overlords. I understand how that goes. I have my own feline overlords, who actually, I believe, might make an appearance in this episode. Fuck yeah. All right, well, this is a very fun conversation that I learned a lot from and I found a lot of use in, and so I hope that all of you do as well. Here's my chat with J.S. Groves. Cheers.
Man getting bit by an alligator and he screams. Man getting bit by an alligator and screams.
All right, well, my guest today is Jeffrey Groves. Jeffrey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Doing well, thank you. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. I'm very excited to hear about your jewelry and the blog and all of the rest of it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited to talk about it. This is my first public appearance since going dark mid-2020.
All right. Well, welcome back to the public sphere, I suppose. For people who aren't like familiar with your work, could you go ahead and give the listener's eye a little bit of a background about what you're into and what you're up to and all of that good stuff?
Yeah. So I'm Jeffrey. I'm known in many internet circles as Sater Magos. I'm a jeweler, novelist, photographer, and sometime public ritualist. My really big thing that I'm doing right now is my jewelry store, The Sorcerer's Workbench, where I sell talismanic and devotional jewelry and art jewelry for, I like to say, the discerning witch and magician, because, I feel like a lot of the jewelry that gets targeted at us is, on the one hand, kind of pigeonholed, and on the other hand, really misses a lot of opportunities. So I guess I can talk about that in a lot more detail in a minute. I run a blog called Journey Through the Obsidian Dream. I got started just before the peak of the like 2010 to 2012 occult blogosphere. I never had a whole lot of followers, but like the followers I did have were like a couple of the big names of the time, which was kind of awesome for me personally. And I write about my ritual experiences there. I try to go for an intermediate audience, people who are have been around the magical block but are still like, okay, I've read 6 grimoires, now what do I do with them? Because that's where I've spent most of my magical career. And yeah, I write novels and take photos with a target audience of weirdos and queers and witches and magicians, because the art movement has always been a part of the occult revival. And I'm enjoying being a part of that tradition.
All right. Fuck yeah. I love it. So what would you say makes your jewelry work different than some of the stuff that's out there?
The big thing that makes my jewelry work different from most of what's out there are the fact that I'm doing it all in my consecrated home studio. Everything I make with my own hands. I don't have partners overseas doing the mass production. And all of my jewelry is either specifically citing a particular grimoire. Like it's fair to say that I'm either most famous for my Hecateon talismans or my Picatrix talismans, or by some kind of divine inspiration in the cases of the devotional pieces. I think that that's probably what makes my work different from a lot of what's out there. Not that there's no one else doing that.
So for somebody who's like maybe not familiar with doing this type of work, or even like with grimoire magic or anything like that, can you kind of paint us a little bit of a picture about like what this work looks like and like what kind of goes into it?
Yeah, absolutely. So starting with the Picatrix, for those who don't know, that's a medieval Arabic manuscript on astrological magic. It details how to choose an election, which is to say an opportune astrological moment, and then what to do with it. It was originally written in Arabic. It was then translated into Castilian Spanish, and then from there into Latin, and from Latin into English. And while there are a couple really solid versions of that, we are literally all waiting with bated breath for someone to put out a new direct from Arabic translation, because if you've studied even one not English language, you understand how awkward translation can get. And like, with no fault to any translator along the way, when you do that like series of translations without a referral back to the original, you're gonna get some weird artifacts.
Absolutely. A touchstone for me here is the idea that over in Japan, they have a tradition of eating Kentucky Fried Chicken for Christmas. You know, it's not a Christian country. Like, the concept of Christmas is like, what's that, right? Like, but there was this very successful marketing campaign back in the 70s in which KFC, you know, was like, oh yeah, hey, it's this Christmas thing, have a bucket of chicken like everyone does or whatever. And so yeah, that's I think that's just such a great touchstone for how things change when they cross like maybe cultural boundaries or something like that.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And like I was having a conversation with someone about gender in astrological magic, and I was pointing out that in that string of translations, you had at least that many irreconcilable notions of what it meant to be a man or a woman. And so assigning gender to the planets is like, what? The big thing about Picatrix in particular, and a lot of other astrological talisman magic, is that it comes down to these images of all the things I prepped, I didn't think to have this up, but for example, my first was the Picatrix image of Venus. I chose one which describes Venus as a woman with the head of a bird and the feet of an eagle, holding an apple in one hand and a comb in the other, and a series of Greek letters below her feet. And whoever carries this image will be well received and liked by all.
Especially the ladies, if I recall correctly.
So, if you know anything about pre-modern magic, and honestly, frankly, a lot of modern magic, the presumed audience is a straight dude trying to fuck a cis lady. And there's just an assumed audience and an assumed target.
Sure.
Actually, interestingly, specifically, this image is about friendship and esteem, where there are other images that are more about like trying to find somebody to fuck. I go through the Picatrix. I look at these. There's five or six images in the one main section for each of the planets, and there's other images elsewhere that because organization was something that was invented hundreds of years later. And I looked at them and I was like, what can I draw that'll fit in a 1-inch circle? Because that's my first criteria. Can I even physically make it? And then having decided that I can physically make it, I then study the image and I do sketches and eventually come up with something that looks like the description and feels like magic. And, you know, now that I'm starting my second round of Picatrix images, that finding the thing that feels right is coming a lot faster. Sometimes the technical excellence takes a couple more rounds of revision. According to the most traditional methods, you carve this image onto a stone in the elected time, except it's not physically possible to do that. Like, your average planetary election is 30 minutes long. Mm-hmm. You can't do a detailed drawing on the back of a cabochon in that amount of time. So some people get around this by just kind of like scratching the idea of the image on it and not really making a carving. Myself and a few others get around this by prepping everything in advance and then through lost wax casting, producing the image in the opportune astrological moment.
Okay.
Obviously, there's also like paper talismans and like, so you like finish a painting at the time. But the idea is that like you get it to like a certain viable state of completion in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Did I actually come back around to start there, or did I just get lost in the woods?
No, I think we're talking about Picatrix. We're talking about what this looks like in terms of making talismanic jewelry out of these images.
Okay, cool. I did come full circle in. Yeah. So
I think so.
And Agrippa has similar images. Some are exactly the same. Some are different. A lot of the images for some of the other, for like the deacons, come from Indian, as in India, astrology, because that's a little bit less of a broken tradition. And so they have some stuff there. There's a lot of little books. One of the things that I'm really interested in getting into eventually, but I'm not quite there yet, is 21st century images acquired by modern mystics.
Very cool. Hell yeah.
And I guess that is what I'm doing with the devotional images, the Hecate, the Dionysus, the Zeus.
So for people who haven't seen the types of things that you make, could you describe like what some of the jewelry that you make looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of have a standard template for my Picatrix talismans and my devotional, which is a 1-inch circle, which is two-sided. And on like the Picatrix, or eventually as I get into Agrippa, you've got like the image on one side. So like the bird woman for Venus, there's a bird-headed dude with a wand and a tree for the moon. I really like my lion-headed dude who's on the front of the Jupiter talisman. And on the back, what I've got is a double circle design. And in the middle of the center circle, there's the grand planetary seal of the planet from Agrippa. Because I've had a lot of good luck with that. And in the outer circle, there's the traditional, like the one everybody knows, glyph of the planet at the top. And on the bottom, there's the Agrippan characters, which are just these really fun, like could have come out of the 80s magical squiggles that I just love. And I'm going to get tattooed on my flesh one of these days, when I have time and the money at the same time.
Love it.
And so most of the time people buy them with just a simple ring bail on top. So you can wear it on a basic necklace chain. I also sell them as coins for people who just want to keep it in their pocket. And with three rings for weaving into like a rosary style prayer bead. And I've released a couple of those, just kind of the prayer beads of my own design. Those aren't as popular for whatever reason. That's fine. I think they're cool, and it costs me nothing extra to have that option available for the people who agree with me. But yeah, so that's like the planetary talismans, the devotional images. You know, it varies from one god to the next. My two most popular of that are my Hecate images. One based on my work with Jack Rayl's Hecateon, which has the eye and six hands image. From the book on one side, and on the back it has a crossroads sigil and several of her epithets in Greek around the outside.
Very cool. Fuck yeah.
And then one that was commissioned by a friend of mine, who he then made it available to everyone, which is Hecate Sotera, which is an image of Hecate based off of, I believe it was the Virgin of Guadalupe on one side, and then a Tudor rose on the back.
Very cool.
And I just did one for Ariana Serpentine, who wanted it, who made available again to the public, specifically in my pride line for the year, of Kybele, the mother of the gods, with her on her throne, with surrounded by lions on the front, and on the back a pair of pine trees from based on a shrine of hers that was found in an Asclepion on the back.
Rad. Could you tell us a little bit more about what's in the Pride line?
So I've now put out two Pride lines. They are half serious, half joking, all jewelry. my this year, I was a little bit more serious. I have a pair of like Dionysiac eyes. So for those of you who aren't classics nerds or specifically Dionysiacs, one of the things about Dionysus is that when you are worshiping the god, specifically through dance or drinking, you are possessed by the god. That possession is contagious. You can be possessed by the god, even if you're not participating in the ritual, by looking into the eyes of someone who is possessed by the god, or even a mask bearing the eyes of Dionysus. And they actually have some commonalities with like Gorgonions, but that's a but like, so I did those in the collar pins that were super fashionable like 5 or 6 years ago. And I did a lambda signet ring because well, signet rings have been a huge part of queer signaling in the United States and the UK over the last 100 years. And the lambda, because that got picked up as a gay signifier in the late 70s, specifically. And I also did a this year a divine hermaphroditus image, which is, depending on the version of the story you go with, either just an intersex or trans vision of Aphrodite, one of her erotes, the children of Aphrodite who represent and or inspire specific desires, or overlapping with that, the child of Aphrodite and Hermes. There's also the version in Ovid, but Ovid is to actual Greek and Roman religion very much what, no, that I was gonna say what Marvel Comics is to heathenry, but that's more like more like what Mel Gibson movies are to Christianity.
I love it. That's a very fun metaphor.
Like, it's intelligible to the actual people, and maybe even appeals to some of the worst of them, but it's not religious text. My year before that was an image of Sappho, who was a Greek poet who was iconic. She was from Lesbos. She's the reason gay women are called lesbians. And this goes all the way back to ancient Rome. It is not a 21st century invention. And Atinous, who was the gay lover of the Emperor Hadrian, who was raised to godhood after he fell off a boat and drowned in the Nile. And then, you know, the silliness, two pairs of bisexual sword earrings.
All right, fuck yeah, I love it.
So those are my two gay pride lines. I'm hoping to put out another line next year. I've already got a few plans for it. Gonna try to get it out closer to Beltane than June 1st, so that with shipping, people can have it in time for celebrations.
Fuck yeah. Well, I want to hear more about all of this, but what do you say we take a bibliomancy break?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Hey, what's up? It's me, Luxa, from the even more distant future, here with a couple of additional things to let you know about. First, check out the show notes or the LuxaCult Instagram feed to see a very cool green mushroom image that Jeffrey created, featuring the alluring MB666 ones and Pixie Butt on Instagram. The image is of them summoning the Hypho Sigil or something adjacent to that. To learn more about the Green Mushroom Project, check out greenmushroomproject.com or come hang out with us on our Discord server, where you can also find our sibling project, Administrism. So speaking of the Discord, there's a couple of upcoming things which we're pretty stoked about. On Friday the 8th of September 2023, author Ramon Castellanos will be giving a talk about sovereignty. He's put some videos together to let folks check out, and we'll be discussing their contents as part of the event. We're going to be doing a six-way study group starting in November, led by Laura. If you're into or curious about some of the practices that Aidan Wachter has laid out in that very good book, join us to find practitioners who share that interest or curiosity. All right, and now I will pass it off here to Luxa from the less distant future. Cheers.
Hey, Luxa, what do you have there? It looks like a tattered old Discord server.
Oh, this old thing? It's pretty beat up. But if I do this...
Sweet! Now that you peeled off the outer bits, it looks fresh as hell.
We should call it the Green Machine.
Awesome! I fucking hate it!
That's okay. It should function alright. But it would probably work better if we had more people.
Yeah. We have an awesome crew of chaotes, occultists, socialists, witches, and weirdos, but there's always room for more.
Absolutely. If you'd like to take part in any of our many chats, rituals, workshops, clubs, and more, hit me up and I will send you a link. You can reach me at luxacultpod@gmail.com or at luxacultpod on Instagram.
And remember, resist.
Hey, what's up? It's me, Luxa from the future. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. We're going to be getting back to my conversation with Jeffrey Groves in just a bit here, as well as that bibliomancy break. We're going to get into some more stuff about using and thinking about stuff from the Picatrix and astrological magic. Jeffrey has some great tips about how to contextualize what we find there. We also get into more stuff about the god Dionysus, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Also, madness and the healing from it. We talk a little bit about modern Dionysiac worship, and Jeffrey shares some great advice about performing public ritual and more. It is now time for the episode within the episode featuring art worldbuilding from the Great Game by Art Worldbuilding podcast, which you can find on Spotify. We dive right into some philosophical musings about identity and all kinds of other good stuff. Art also presents seven steps for approaching how games, in the game theory sense, play out and asks us to consider which magical circles we stand in that we might not be aware we have entered or that we didn't choose to enter. Lots of good food for thought there. To lead us into that, since it came up in my conversation with Jeffrey Groves, I wanted to share some Sappho with you all. This is actually the last thing that remains of hers, as far as I understand. I've read this on this show before, but it's a classic and it's very fun to recite, so I will do so now. Honestly, I can't fucking help myself. Cheers. Here's Ode to Venus by Sappho.
O Venus, beauty of the skies, to whom a thousand temples rise, gaily false in gentle smiles, full of love perplexing wiles. O goddess, from my heart remove the wasting cares and pains of love. If ever thou hast kindly heard a song in soft distress preferred, proprietous to my tuneful vow, a gentle goddess, hear me now. Descend thou bright immortal guest, and all thy radiant charms confessed. Thou once didst leave almighty Jove, and all the golden roofs above, the car thy wanton sparrows drew, hovering in the air they lightly flew. As to my bower they winged their way, I saw their quivering pinions play. The birds dismissed, while you remain, bore back their empty car again. Then you, with looks divinely mild, in every heavenly feature smiled, and asked what new complaints I made, and why I called you to my aid. What frenzy in my bosom raged, and by what cure to be assuaged? What gentle youth would I allure, whom in my artful toils secure? Who does thy tender heart subdue? Tell me, Sappho, tell me who. Though now he shuns thy longing arms, he soon shall court thy sightly charms. Though now thy offerings he despise, he soon to thee shall sacrifice. Though now he freezes, he soon shall burn, and be thy victim in his turn. Celestial visiant, once more, thy needful presence I implore. In pity come and ease my grief, bring my distempered soul relief. Favor thy supplicant's hidden fires, and give me what my heart desires.
All right, cheers, fuck yeah.
Man getting bit by an alligator and he screams. Man getting bit by an alligator and he screams.
All right, well, my guest today is Art World Building. How are you doing today?
Hello, I'm good. I'm good. I just came from the gym. You know, it always feels super great. It's kind of my way to vanish. Also, took a cold shower, some meditation, and it always feels great, you know?
Nice. Okay, very cool. So you're all ready to go then. For folks who aren't familiar with your work, could you give us a little bit of an introduction about who you are, what you're into and up to, and all of that good stuff?
Yeah. Oof. This question is always difficult for me because it's like dealing frontwards with identity. And of course, it's identity what I'm kind of dealing with when I try to do whatever it is I am doing. So it's definitely not a question that can be addressed like with free of aesthetic or philosophical components in my case. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but as magic is both the topic of the podcast Luxa and my quintessence at the moment, I will attack on that flank because I think
that sounds good. We have to start somewhere.
yeah that's what makes more sense, right? So so for Westerners, we always take from the Bible this quote of in the beginning it was the word. It's kind of like mainstream culture in a way. So when you're asking this to someone, they mostly, like the question they ask me, they mostly answer by giving out their name as a response, you know. So if you ask me, who are you, then I will answer, I'm Guillermo Chucarro from Bilbao or something like that, you know. I will toss you a couple of names, and then if you're enough informed about what they mean, then you might know, like Bilbao, well, it's a city that it's in Spain, in the north of Spain, in Basque Country, and so on. And Guillermo might have, maybe as a name, might have like certain class signification or narrative significance for the person that puts it to someone. So as a Westerner, it's always about the name, right? Even maybe would give you an ID number, maybe in their case, if they're at some bureaucratic institution or something. But yeah, so then my name is Guillermo. It's a Latinization of an Anglo-German name, which is William, which probably your listeners have heard before. And it's a name that it's originated by the composition of the two words will and helm, which is basically intention and protection. And it's interesting how important is here the word will in a culture or Western esoteric practices. That's the roots to the word. It ties back to the word magic. So see, magic evolves from mag ik, which is in Dutch still is being used like that. Mag ik, it means may I. So if we use Spinoza's terms, We're defined by our potency. This, what we are doing, is defined by our potency. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, that's very cool.
And I find this really, really special. And so how do you really tell someone who you are without barely explaining what you do, right? So yeah, the way to, like, maybe the front end thing, the front end things are giving you a name, but I think it's also good to kind of map what I've done or how I reached this point so far. There are kind of four moments in my life that were important in what respects to reaching magic as a practice or as a space to explore, well, maybe my way through art or something. And, well, this character called Guillermo, first time felt included and understood by people that would explain things to me and help me think differently in a communal summer camp led by a great Spanish modern school educationist, Josefa Martín Luengo. I hear a cat over there.
Yes, I do have a little helper here with me.
Nice. That's lovely. It's good to know that you're well accompanied. It's surprising how cats can be interrupting really interesting situations. felt that I was someone when I was hanging out with these people. It was summer camps in which we would work together to take care of the place. We'd clean the place, but we would also have discussions around really, really cutting edge political and topics like text from Foucault or Machiavelli, you know, like really philosophical stuff. And as a kid, that's extremely nurturing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But then that was kind of like parallel to my high school life, which was awful. And I can sum it up by saying that video games and joints were the thing. But when I got to university, I look back and now it feels like a beast was released, you know, high school ended and boom, you enter university. And as I studied arts, it was crazy. And that beast that needed to be tamed and collapsed after living in the Netherlands for a while in an exchange program, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago now, I realized how cultural patterns deeply shape our behavior and attention. And my reality really crumbled down, you know, in this collision of cultures between Dutch and Spanish. And I think it has a lot to do with the religious, the theologies of both countries, how Catholicism and Protestantism collapse with one another in a way, you know? So years later, learning to use certain tools for illustration, that gave me the boost to publish a board game that was successfully funded via Kickstarter under the title Outside Beyond the SCP Facilities, which can actually be downloaded for free. I can provide you with the link. And the release of Cube to the Cube, that was a book in which I tried to kind of grasp the ultimate nature of reality, which I found out that was actually impossible. And I did it in quite a depressive state. well, as a result, I had those two artifacts of culture, or maybe even secretions, you know, because I understand that objects are always like kind of a vestige of human activity. Mm-hmm. I already had those, you know, a game published and a behemoth poetic prose that was astonishing me in visuals. So this kind of four moments in my life were crucial in what I consider myself to be, if we can maybe say that in a way. And lately, after attending the Spanish version of The Burning Man, I realized how important certain Dutch ethics and cultural analysis were to me through authors like Spinoza or Huizenga. Now I'm kind of in a process of re-identification, or in Deleuzian terms, re-territorialization, because it's not just moving physically, but also there's a cultural territory and there's a moral territory, and I'm also rearranging all the structures, power, mentally, physically, and many layers. And I'm trying to understand which are the elements that I see repeated throughout my narrative and trying to set my identity via those. And well, it's not easy. I don't know if you've ever traveled yourself.
I've done a little bit of traveling. I'd like to do more. I'm planning on doing a lot more coming up here. So yeah.
Yeah. So it's always kind of ground shaking.
Yeah. It's a really cool way of getting a different perspective. Absolutely.
So overall, if I had to identify myself with a cosmogonic look, I would say maybe I'm a pantheist. God is in nature, but not just in living things. but everywhere, you know, everything is nature, as Grant Morrison said in his famous talk at this InfoCon. I don't know if you watched that one, but
yeah, it's a classic. It's been coming up recently a lot. Totally,
it's a classic. It's so good. So we are nature. We also are nature. And I stand by that, you know. The artificial is also nature, and this is not something new. Again, Spinoza was already saying that. I think it was in the 18th century, maybe the 19th century. He was saying, "Deus sive natura," which means nature equals God, or it's the same thing. So it's natura naturata, is that thing which happens for itself, and it's constantly happening, which ties back to Taoism and that cosmo conception. Is I find really interesting how Western and Eastern culture tie together in Spinoza, and this is why I don't understand the being as something separate from the rest of existence, as we commonly depict in modern Christianism. You know, the fall of man, or the fall of human. Maybe I would interpret it like that. But yeah, me from you. From them, there's intrinsically not difference. There may be maybe formal differences. There are maybe practical differences. But as soon as you dive deeper into it, you find out that there is not really. And then that you can always find a way to connect with people if you search. But that this is the paradox, because, you know, the unknown and the vacuum still exist. There is still something that is beyond the abyss, as we put it in magical slang, you know. And here is where we find ourselves realizing that the word that can be pronounced is not the actual word, which is how the Tao Te Ching opens, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The Tao that can be spoke of is not actually the Tao.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. And so that kind of clash around the terms of what the word means in alchemy, I find it really interesting how the Western and the Eastern perspectives clash on one hand, but at the same time they are also talking about the same thing. And I think it's because of my practice of judo that I got interested in this. I kind of was when I was 5, I started practicing judo with some of my friends, and people would drop, you know, along the years, but I kind of remained. I don't know if it was because I wanted to or because my parents forced me to keep practicing it, you know. But yeah, nowadays, because of the discipline of judo, or maybe because of the philosophy of judo, I understand that the life as a continuum being, you know, the separation is an illusion in essence. It's a topic that is interesting to look at by reading. I don't know if you read the text on the origin of the world, which is a Gnostic text, a kind of, yeah, well, questions radically the God we conceive in the Bible as the ultimate truth, in a way. Yeah. Did you take a look at that one?
No, I haven't actually checked that out before. The idea of, like, the kind of Christian conception of God, it's not really, like, something that's ever been, like, a big part of my, like, worldview. Like, I wasn't raised religiously or anything, so it's not necessarily been something that I've had to question in the same way that others have, right? So it hasn't been like as big of an area of interest to me, but I do think it's just from an anthropological sense, like, fascinating. Absolutely.
It's interesting because I kind of I walk down the road thinking that everyone has had to to face the big gods of the desert in a way, you know?
Sure. And I mean, I'm guessing that that's definitely in there. It's not like I was raised on an island divorced from, you know, our very Christian culture that, you know, that I was raised in. So it's definitely there. But it's, yeah, it's interesting to me. In speaking to others, there's a sort of like relationship that some people seem to have with these concepts that I never really connected with, but I'm working on connecting with in a very intentional way in my own practice, just to kind of see what that experience is like.
Oh, this thing you're mentioning is really interesting, because yeah, like I would myself say that I was not exposed to religion in a forced or direct way. You know, my mom was kind of like New Agey type, and my dad was an iconoclast.
Okay, so maybe more similar to what I had then. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but at the same time, I know that if my dad was an iconoclast, he was because he was rejecting Christianism. And
sure,
I know
sure.
that if my mom was on this New Agey gestaltic type of thing, it was also because she was deviating from that kind of narrative of power that was going on all throughout. So even though I am not directly exposed and I didn't have to kind of escape the cult of hegemonical Christianity, I think it's interesting to look at it because as a deviant, that I see myself as a deviant. I've always been really in love with anarchist narrative. So seeing myself as such, I think it's a good job to try to look at Christianity with this really, really critical eye and try to apply maybe those anarchist teachings to this overarching narrative that is kind of imposing power in a way to our daily lives.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, yeah, Gnosticism is great for that. Absolutely. Very cool.
So maybe that this is the aspect in which I find interesting Gnosticism that is the basis for later alchemy. And as you can tell by now, I'm influenced by which and how stories are told and taking a look at those archived stories that might be hidden in order to open the discourse around narratives. And especially, I like how Eastern and Western thought collide, as I mentioned before, around the specific tropes. So this is why I like The Matrix and Dark Souls. Those two pieces are of such importance in the way I look at the world, let's say. It's not like I like to have a narrative. I really like to always question that, you know, but there is always a narrative that kind of wants to keep happening. And I think it's honest and really humble to accept there are narratives that are influencing you and trying to understand what your own biases are. I think that's part of the process of individuation or start casting spells, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, I love it. So let's talk a little bit about your show, The Great Game, and let's talk about the name and how that kind of ties into things, because I think it's a really cool way of like recontextualizing magical work.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, I'm actually happily invited here because you came to the show.
Yes, that's right. If people are enjoying this conversation, they can hear more of us speaking to one another on your show, which I really enjoyed that conversation. Even though I misspoke, I think I said 43 instead of 42 or something. but regardless, it was a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed it. So yes, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for having me. But yeah, you know, like 43, I guess when we read Aleister Crowley, we are influenced by his own 93 thing. And, I assume that it might be a mixture of terms, but you know, like deviant, you know, like it happens and things mix around, and I think that's great. So The Great Game, I basically broadcasted all your conversations addressing the reality threshold of liminality, striving to generate meaning from it. Joined by our guest, we dive into philosophical, aesthetic, or spiritual mindscapes and their political and cognitive consequences. This is all in an attempt to find correspondences between alchemy and game design. We do all of this by taking a bit of a rest from life to look at it as if it was a game. This suspended space speculates about how our activities can play as means to compose ethical communities supported by individual empowerment. And the overall question is it possible to build a gamified tool for what Deleuze calls reterritorialization?
So for people who aren't familiar with Deleuze's work, could you go into what that term means a little bit?
Yeah, Richard. Well, it's as all the delusion terminology, it's fuzzy, you know, because it's used in a very it's used as a piece to kind of connect several things that Deleuze finds disconnected in language.
It's like there's a lot more like verbs than nouns, right? Like everything is something that, yeah, I don't know. Hard to explain, for sure.
Yeah, it's weird. I haven't really dived so much into Deleuze, but the thing with him is that he always kind of plays with words he uses them in a very poetic way. But the overarching idea of, or at least as I understand reterritorialization in this case, is about how relationships of power restructured through time, and then how the different components or agents kind of find themselves in this clash is mostly an imposition of power from certain groups towards others, but there's always changes within this. And so when an individual migrates, which is my case, for example, they find this as re-territorialized. But if I get colonized, or, well, not me, because I actually belong to a colonizing country, but if a country gets colonized, then they are also being re-territorialized because a narrative is being imposed over those territories as well. So it's a bit of a confusing word. It can be confusing, but it kind of deals with all this stuff.
Okay, hell yeah, thank you.
But again, I like to point out that although I'm very influenced by the culture of alchemy and the academia, I need to say that I'm not a historian, I'm not a philologist, I'm not a semiologist. So my field is limited to aesthetics and anything that might be considered a symbol and how this is used in a very, very direct way. So please don't take my word as a thesis or any sort. I can also say that I can serve as an inspiration or as a way to look at things from outside the box. And this is the whole point, you know, that I'm trying to address. Like, why I'm here is that I believe all of this mercurial love has to be cast opening gateways by asking questions. So, yeah.
Okay. So, Art, you had let me know that there was some kind of a cool artifact, perhaps, maybe would be the correct term here, that you were hoping to share with the listeners and I. What is that?
Yeah, in the last week's release interview with Stephanie Geek1 on Instagram, Geek_1 on Instagram, we were talking about, I think it was problems, and I was actually thinking on talking about on reading Valerie's letter from Alan Moore, but I snapped and I said, I really need to share this information because it's so interesting. So according to Johann Hausinger, most of the cultures have the magical circle. It's the circle that marks the separation within the given culture's cosmogony. And that is where worship happens. And it's very remarkable how worshiping in Spanish is translated as to surrender cult. We say to surrender cult instead of worshiping. Yeah. And we all belong to this process. It's a very process of a game, and we can adopt it can adopt many forms. This is what human beings are doing by trying to strive for meaning. They embark themselves in narratives and games. And well, frequently, if not always, this is a magical circle. This magical circle is a safe space for power play to happen. But as the times there are a changing, as Bob Dylan shall put it, we might be taking place a magical circus that we don't even notice. And what I see, it's our duty as magical thinkers to reinforce our consciousness and agency towards them and deciding whether we want to take part of them or not. That's why that's what freedom seems to be about to me lately. In my personal practice, doing this has allowed me to free myself from certain rituals I was practicing automatically and start being able to just maintain my personal routines by accepting that the set objective is rather a horizon or a utopia. Then I switched from the neurotic need to be the winner into entering a state of winning or of acceptance at moving on. So this artifact, it's basically, I've kind of puzzled it as a seven aspects in which, well, taking the reference from Jesse Schell in The Art of Game Design, the Book of Lenses, I kind of have taken that reference and kind of extrapolated it to life's patterns. And basically, Jesse Schell says that playing games is about confronting a problem, like in Donna Haraway's title, you know, keeping up with the problem, keeping up with the trouble. It's about trying to solve a trouble. And I wanted to share, how can we detect these games? And it's a seven-step thing. In the first step, the existence of games is defined as these being problem-solving tools, as I've mentioned. So it is up to the individual or group of individuals who define the game to estimate which problem takes relevance. And this as a first spot is like of crucial importance. Mm-hmm. Because being a linear explanation that I'm giving, it's going to influence all the rest. It's paradoxical, but that's how it goes. That's how the first step of the fool goes. So from here, from this point, and this is the second point, a clear goal is defined. You have a first definition of the trouble, and then you have a goal. You have a will. You're a statement of intent, if you want to say. So we establish a framework by defining the methods we're going to use. This is the third spot. And we research the problem and establish its rules. Games have them. Toys, artifacts, fetishes don't. So that's interesting. Game is alive and the artifact is, in a way, it's not. And that interaction it's crucial how rules play a role in that difference. For the fourth step, we set up in our minds a simplified version of reality. And this is for certain people easier to interact with as active participants. And some other people don't have it so easy. I guess that's the very basic element of discrimination within a group that you can see.
Okay, so this is like a sort of like modeling, like sort of building like a model, if you will, of the system.
It's building a model of games, but I can see clearly how it can also be used to take a look at mm-hmm. cultures and the way groups behave. And I think it's a very interesting lens to look at life. So that's the fourth aspect. And for the fifth aspect, the active participant to reach that goal, our goal maybe, if you want to say, would be challenging if it involves the right amount of conflict to become engaged and kind of forget about the real world. So if the game actually demands that amount of conflict, that is not too much, but not too few, then we find ourselves kind of forgetting what the real world is. And that's tricky. That's the most tricky thing, because it's about letting go. The sixth aspect, which is the previous to the last one, is how the activity gains an amount of internal importance that might not be relevant outside of the problem, is where we enter a trance. So we enter a trance, and whatever happens inside is not valuable in the outside. And last but not least, we defeat the problem or are defeated by it, causing an unbalanced outcome. Well, so yeah, this is basically the model a bit of a modification of the model that is proposed by Jesse Shelton in his book. And I would like to also propose a little exercise now to everyone that is listening. So guys, take paper and pen, because this might be interesting to do. I don't know if am I allowed, or
it's up to the listeners whether or not they're going to do it or not. You're absolutely allowed to share. Sounds cool.
just looking for that little piece of consent from you.
Thank you.
So, I love to close up by opening, and I do that by tossing questions, opening doorways, and in this case, I will ask everyone: which things do you in your daily life that you might not be considering magical practice be taking part in a pattern that you're following? So I will try to formulate it again. Which things do you in your daily life that you might be not considering magical practice and yet you follow this pattern? Yeah, I think it's quite interesting to look at that. And those things are probably magical. And it's also possible that you're giving up that magic to someone else. Make yourself sure that's something you really want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that, sort of taking a good look at what you're participating in and what that means and whether you want that or not.
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah, very cool. Thank you.
Thank you, Luxan.
So where can listeners find your work?
Well, my great work can be found perhaps on Instagram, by looking for @worldbuilding. So I'll send you just the information so you can leave it on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can also find the podcast on Spotify by looking for The Great Game by Art World Building. You can also download the book and the game for print and play at to print it and play it at your place. at my website. But yeah, that's of second significance.
Okay, well, if you wouldn't mind sharing links to that as well. I know there's a lot of gamers in the audience out there, so folks might be curious to check that out as well.
Yeah, I would love to.
All right, fantastic. Well, do you have any last thoughts or anything like that you would like to share with the listeners before I let you go?
I do, Luxa. I would probably could be extending here my infinite discourse for hours and hours. I'm going to respect the time that's been given, and I will cut it right here.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Luxa. It's always a pleasure.
All right, fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Art Worldbuilding, aka Guillermo, for joining me. Really cool conversation. Don't forget to check out the show notes for a great reading list that he put together for folks who are interested as well. You can find The Great Game by Art Worldbuilding on Spotify, and soon I'm told on other platforms as well. And you can hear me speak about my work as looked at through the lens of playfulness on that show. It was a great conversation and an honor to be invited. So thank you so much to Art Worldbuilding for that. Okay, so there's a lot to think about in Guillermo and I's conversation. After we recorded this, I actually did go back and revisit some Spinoza. During the recording, we had quite a few tech issues that caused some diciness and led to some miscommunication. But such as podcasting, there's always going to be noise along with any signal, and this is compounded by things like distance, technology, language, and all of that good stuff. And it's worth keeping in mind, right? You never actually hear what you think you hear. Might be a way of putting it. There's always going to be noise in with the signal, and miscommunication is actually an inherent feature of communication. So that's something good to keep in mind, and it's one that presents some interesting challenges for sure. Anyway, as you might have figured out based on what I said in the intro, I've been very into hanging out with Spinoza lately. He was an interesting person, and there's a lot from his biography in terms of how he dealt with having these, I guess at the time, like pretty fucking subversive ideas that makes me nod my head in agreement. I also sometimes doubt the existence of an eternal soul, which is something that a lot of my occulty friends seem to like raise an eyebrow at. Honestly, it's probably a semantic thing about the definition of a soul. I don't know. Anyway, I've only breached the sort of tip of the iceberg with my boy Baruch, but there's already a lot of conceptual intersection having to do with things that have been coming up lately in my work over the past year or so, especially regarding this new album I'm working on. I feel like we sort of might have come to some of the same places in our meditations, only I've approached it from the opposite side of things, right? I'm like a product of Spinoza's thought making a pilgrimage back to its source as the serpent swallows its tail. I think a lot about what power is in the sense of the word from physics, like something that does work over time, or in the sense of it being like what the world is made up of, as well as what causes change and motion and all the other things in the world, and how power might operate in a very broad sense when applied to different systems. And I like to look at how it sort of manifests in different areas of life across different fields and orders of magnitude. It's what things like magic, religion, politics, history, art, sexuality, and a bunch of other things kind of revolve around in an operational sense, at least. I use my meditations on the concept as a sort of like meta context for trying to like grok the way the world functions and how to best live in it. And I think that Spinoza would say that what I call power is also what he calls nature and what is also called God or idea die, the idea of God. So our dude Baruch ends up concluding, as Art mentions in our conversation, that God is nature. Here I think it might be helpful to pause and look at these words, nature and God. In a modern colloquial sense, we think about it, nature maybe as being like trees and birds and stuff like that. And for most of us, nature is something that is out there, separate, out the window or whatever. This context would probably, we could point to a lot of this coming up in like Christian thought, like there's a sort of abhorrence about the outside world, outside of like the little circles of control, which are delineated by maybe like a village or something like that. And along with the instruction to subjugate the natural world. And that's kind of, you know, prevalent in a lot of Christian thought over the centuries. So for a lot of people, for a while, there was this idea like God lives in the church and the devil lives in the woods or in nature. Not so much for Baruch Spinoza. He was always sort of a heretic. As a sidebar, when he was 23, he was kicked out of the local Talmud Torah congregation of Amsterdam for abominable heresies, like espousing unpopular ontological views in public. In his work, after stating his proof of the existence of God, Spinoza goes on to address, like, who or what God is. Spinoza states that God is the sum of the natural and physical laws of the universe, and certainly not is an individual entity or creator. He instead goes in the direction of everything in the universe as being part of God, and that God is actually the substance of the universe and the sum of all the substances in the universe. And God is the only substance in the universe, and everything is a part of God. So this view was described by Charles Hartthorne as classical pantheism, which makes sense because it reminds us of a lot of ideas that we might encounter in the religions of India and other places. Thanks, by the way, to Wikipedia and Britannica Philosophy Encyclopedia. Okay, so this substance that is the universe, God, and everything else isn't just formless blobs doing nothing, as we've all noticed. Everything operates according to some principle. Say it's principle of nature, or the way that God iterates through it would perhaps be another way of saying it. So this is like a machine which carries out functions according to the nature of its design. Every component of reality can be looked at like a machine, and these machines are latticed together to form another larger machine of infinite complexity, and that's our reality. So at this point, I can't help but mention the Wolfram Physics Project, which looks at the sort of like cybernetic unfolding of our reality and searches for the fundamental formula of the configuration of our particular universe, like source code, maybe, if you will. Anyway, I'm sort of going off into the woods here with my own thoughts or take on Spinoza, and we still have a bunch of very cool conversation with Jeffrey Groves to enjoy. So I'm going to leave it here and share a clip from a much longer track off of my upcoming album, which is titled Void Machine, subtitled Adjustment, coming this fall. I've ventured into some new territory with this project and have really pushed myself to step outside of my comfort zone magically. It's been important work to me and has been the type of circle, if you will, from arts conversation that I can step into and explore some pretty uncomfortable things in a safe and productive way. So this, to me, is one of the most beautiful things about an artistic practice. We can give ourselves the gift of creating that space for ourselves and explore what we need to in a way that might be much more beneficial to oneself and the world than expressing things in other ways. So on the other side of that, we will return to my chat with Jeffrey Groves to talk more Picatrix and astrological magic, performing public ritual, Dionysus, and much more. Later on after the interview, we will hear some crypto poetry, an update about the Green Mushroom Project, and more. But now, here is a safe for work radio edit of a meditation on the machine and the void, taken from the track Preliminary Invocation off my upcoming album Void Machine, Adjustment. In an orgasmic instant, existence came to be. It was a big bang that even now continues banging. With the pleasure of following a path into a thing, the machine began unfolding from the void. It began building itself in recursive cycles, which grew into complex harmonies. It existed first as the sacred three, the primary trinary of space, time, and motion. It became what it had always been, what it would always be. It became what it must be, an expression of its fundamental formula, recursively reiterated ad infinitum. It became beautiful and monstrous, terrible and astonishing. It danced with itself,
in ways which brought pleasure and ways which brought pain. There were always gaps in it, places where the void could flow in like smoke to dance with it too. And when she caressed the machine's pieces, the void whispered to it of itself. It then became a broken hole, for it had to be shattered in order to be able to look upon itself. And it looked, and it, in conversation with the void, considered what it saw. The machine speaks to itself now. If you listen like the void, you can hear it, and it will tell you how it operates. It will tell you how to touch it, how to make things turn within it. When you hear my words, you do so with the machine's ears. When you look into my eyes, you are looking into the machine's eyes, and you are looking through the machine's eyes. This is why we find ourselves in each other. This is why we want to become part of each other. It's not a fantasy. It's a memory. Remembrance of the machine shattering brings us back to when we were whole. And in the quest for this recollection, we return once more to an understanding of wholeness. At least this is what I'm told. This is the carrot that is teased before me as I tread wearily up a steep slope. I have seen evidence to suggest that this might indeed be the case. In doing the difficult labor engendered by such a journey, I have come across places of beauty as well as of horror. I have found pathos and sharp, brilliant joy. The map is comprised of all manner of states, and each must be explored if one is to become familiar with the territory. It would be easier to walk downhill, to embrace the oblivion of accepting consensus. But I need to see as far as possible. I need to see the way the land lays, to see the swell and curves of it. I need to make deep and passionate love to it with my eyes, to feel it fill me up and press into my expanding mind. I need this because the machine needs it. I want it because the machine wants it to feel with full awareness its dance with itself and with the void.
Well, Jeffrey, do you have a question for the Oracle? And do you have a D4 and a D8? If not, that's okay. I have some right here.
I in fact, have an absurdity of such dice, but I need to run into the other room to get them. If you can bear with me for just a moment.
Oh, sure.
I got a 4 on the 4-sided and a 2 on the 8.
All right. It's going to be from the Book of Mormon. Let me go find it.
That is mind-bogglingly inappropriate.
This one hasn't come up in a while. I'm excited. All right, I'll be right back here. All right, Jeffrey, I have located this text. This is the Book of Mormon, another testament of Jesus Christ, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I think I stole this from a hotel room. That maybe stole is the wrong word. I don't know.
That is how I acquired my copy of the Book of Mormon, though I actually happen to be within a drunken stumble of one of their major temples. Do you know that Independence, Missouri is where Jesus is going to come back?
I mean, I do now. You've heard it here first, folks.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jeffrey, do you have a question for the Oracle?
I do. What lies in store for the Kansas City Sorceress Arts Collective in the next year?
All right. Oh, Eris, what lies in store for the Kansas City Arts Collective in the next year? Zara Hemla, Zeb Ulam, Zechariah, Zedekiah, Zizaram. A lot of Z's.
So, either we're going to lean hard into the barbarous words, or maybe we'll find ourselves some yard husbands.
It's the interesting thing about using books like this is you sometimes land on the pronunciation guide. So there you have it.
Oh, barbarous words it is. Okay, good to know. Good to know.
Thank you, Eris. Always appreciated. Hopefully that's helpful.
Well, it didn't hurt.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking that if one really wanted to, one could go and look at where these names were and what these folks did and all of that and really come up with all kinds of soil which to till there.
So what you're saying is I didn't get an answer. I got homework. That is so on brand. So on brand.
Yeah, it actually is very on brand. So at this point in the interview, I like to ask folks if they have any thoughts that they would like to share about divination in general or their own practices or anything along those lines.
Oh, man. I am a moderately competent diviner surrounded by truly talented diviners. So I have very mixed feelings. I have a daily divination practice that is sometimes very helpful and sometimes absolute gibberish. And I recently switched decks in hopes of, like, you know, maybe getting like a different voice talking in my ear. And I had been using the Lisa Stirl Modern Witch Tarot, which I fucking love and recommend to everybody. But the number of times I would get like three major arcanas for a day that I was supposed to spend on couch lock. So I have just switched to the Alley Man Tarot as of about.
It's the inner work that you do on the couch. Sorry.
Right. Like I guess 25 milligrams and a few hours of The Witcher count as the moon.
I have lots of feelings about that guy.
I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge advocate of a daily practice. It really helps you familiarize you with the deck. But like the one thing I have learned of like having a daily divination practice over the last 3 years is that one day at a time is not the ideal scale for tarot. And also, unless something's actually going to happen that day, you are going to get more noise than signal. And discerning what days are just garbage is a critical skill. That's my biggest thought on divination.
What pointers would you give to people on sort of honing in on determining that?
Oh, man. If y'all have pointers, let me know. I'm real good at coming up with a good question. Coming up with an answer?
I mean, honestly, for me, I feel like just journaling and keeping track of it and like reflecting back and saying, well, was that actually the thing or was that just
I would agree. Yeah. And also not letting a bad daily draw turn into a bad day.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen people who are really into astrology, I feel like kind of fall into what I consider to be a trap with this stuff too. Like it's just because the planets are being mean doesn't mean you have to have a bad day. I might cut that part out.
Oh no, you know what? I'm good to go there. Cause like obviously I am waist deep in the Picatrix. Like I'm not so good at like mundane astrology, like figuring out what the position of the stars means for any given day. The one thing I do know is the more astral magic you do, the more the space weather affects you.
Okay, okay, interesting. Because, yeah, I've been playing a lot with Picatrix, and that's probably good to know for people that are maybe dipping a toe in there.
But, like, you know, as far as, like, predicting the lives of, like, people who aren't kings, astrology is actually still in its infancy. Like, so much of traditional astrology is about what's going on with the ruling class. And you know, so the thing to keep in mind is that let's stick with the weather analogy. 70% chance of rain is 100% chance of rain in 70% of the designated area.
Yes, thank you. A lot of people don't realize that about that statistic.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. And so, like, okay, Saturn is doing this to the moon. First off, what's it doing, you know, respective of your birth chart, which I am not at that level to interpret that information. But also, like, maybe you're just standing in the sunny spot and not getting hit by that. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, people should treat astrological forecasts more like meteorologists, especially in these troubled times.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Hell yeah.
That's my thought on that. And that will annoy both the hardcore astrology nerds in my peer group and the fuck astrology people in my peer group.
Well, everybody will be annoyed, and I'm happy.
Which is where I like to be on so many things.
I hear that. So I was hoping, if you don't mind, we could circle back and talk a little bit more about Dionysus, because I suspect that you might have more to tell me about some of these traditions, and I would love to hear some more.
Kind of a where to start situation. So I guess the first thing to start is that I am a very 21st century Dionysiac. I know more than many people about the ancient traditions, but since I'm not in a position to sacrifice and barbecue a cow, there's not a lot I can do in terms of, like, going back. Also, Dionysus is the god, the one god with whom I have a relationship that looks like religion outside of the circles I run in. So it gets really weird and personal. For me personally, Dionysiac worship is, on the one hand, about physical and spiritual ecstasy. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the grandest tradition. And on the other hand, as someone who has a shit ton of trauma and a lifetime of struggles with mental wellness, Dionysus is also the god I turn to for help with that. Mm. As the god who was cursed with and then cured from madness by the mystic rites of Kybele, specifically, actually. Like, that's what I turn to with Dionysus. And so, as much as I love the drunken revel part, I do sometimes get frustrated with the people who leave out the healing and the mysteries and all of that. Our main sources historically for Dionysiac worship are the state-sponsored sides. Dionysus sponsored the city of Athens sponsored, in the name of Dionysus, the great literary and theatrical festivals. And, like, so he was the patron in that moment of Athens as a whole, but of, like, Athens' literary scene in particular. We also know that Dionysus cult was kind of a point of social contention. One doesn't want to extract too much ritual detail from things like Euripides' Bacchae, but we can see in that there was a lot of social tension around the rituals and their content. Like, the belief was that people were fucking off into the wilderness, not just to drink and dance with the god, but to get inappropriately drunk and have crazy sex.
Do all kinds of taboo yeah. shit. Yes.
And so many of Dionysus' stories revolve around him and his troop coming into a town, the local king, like, being like, man, are you even a god, or are you just a snake oil salesman. And, well, until you acknowledge the god, bad things start happening. And, you know, this theme, you know, is present both in literature and legal documents throughout Greek history, and most legal documents, particularly specifically in Rome, where the cult of Dionysus was originally banned because it was popular with the plebes, who were, of course, doing all of the licentious things. But then a bunch of upper class people got initiated, and then it was okay.
Not much has changed, has it, right?
Yeah, the best and worst part about being a historian is you keep looking at it and being like, man, people have been like this the whole time. The whole time.
Right? It fascinates. My brother and I make a history podcast, and it just, I shake my head, but then I'm like, well, at least it's always been like this. I mean, it's not like it's getting worse, per se.
So we've got 1,000 years of people being like, oh man, that Dionysus cult, there might be something kinky going on there, which tells to me that it both was and wasn't. The pure version of the cult, pure for a working definition, which I will roll my eyes out. The less licentious version of the cult was probably more dominant. It might even be the original version. But you know, based on humans being humans, that at a certain point, somebody decided to make the kinky version real. And probably several somebodies every fucking century along the way.
It's interesting. Yeah, there's like these kind of interesting feedback loops that happen, right? Like we were talking about this at Babylon Rising after some other folks came and approached us at Camp Chaos and told us that we weren't causing enough chaos because we were apparently being nerdy and boring and talking about philosophy around our fire or whatever. And they were like, this is us. Like you're all of that stuff that you're projecting about what chaos magicians are supposed to be like you're that's you. Like those are your ideas that you're projecting onto us. And so, I mean, yes, maybe we could rise to the occasion and give you this experience that you're asking for, but you're kind of helping us create it, right? Like...
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, so like I'm a very 21st century Dionysiac. I make my mead in Dionysus' honor. I pour out offerings to him every day. Actually, mostly coffee, because that's the primary offering that I pour out. Because coffee is life, goddammit. Yeah, we every Beltane and more Samhains than not, my crew and I have a Dionysiac ritual that we do based on a ritual that we experienced at a festival and have then been reproducing and slowly modifying with each iteration.
Very cool. I love it. Do you want to talk a little bit about the collective there?
Yeah. So, okay. So I have a, when I'm talking about my ritual crew, I'm talking about one of two groups with largely overlapping people, but they kind of are, but there's still different groups. The first is my Lunar Shenanigans crew, which is my not a coven, pseudo coven, personal working group. They come to my house at least every 2 weeks to feast and do magic at the moon. We, my partner, several other burned out former leaders of the Kansas City pagan community, some of our very dearest friends. We celebrated our last full moon with a night of political magic, and our next full moon is going to be a ritual inspired by a dream that one of our members had. And then later in August, we're actually going to do the fourth iteration of another ritual that we've picked up, which was based on a vision that I had in the desert on a road trip. It's based on the research that came out of that vision.
Very cool. Yeah, I love this. This sounds fucking dope.
Yeah, it's a really great group, and I love them to death. I will kill, live, or die for them. And then many of the same people are involved in the Kansas City Sorceress Arts Collective, which is a group that, starting with just a few of us, but like more and more signed up for after. Several of us were chased out of more prominent local leadership positions. We were like, all right, well, we still want to do public magic. We want to do workshops. We want to do rituals. What we're going to do is we're going to form a ritual troupe then just try to find venues for our work. And so what we do, what we have done historically, we started in 2018 and had like a real good run for about 2 years. And then like, well, 2020 happened. And so first we weren't doing public things with people and we had to try to have a podcast, but that didn't really work out, mostly because we were all like really depressed. And
it's also a different, it's a completely different thing. Like making a podcast and doing like, you know, public performance is a completely different workflow and shit. So yeah,
it was not playing to our strengths.
Yeah, it's just different shit. So.
Like we had some great conversations, but like the producing and promoting the podcast didn't really go together. But so like we teach workshops and we do rituals. We the two really big rituals. Well, we did one really big ritual at Paganicon in 2019. It was a purification ritual based on the one described in Aeschylus' Oedipus at Colonus. And so what it was, like, Oedipus, you know, first without knowing what was happening, and then when he found out what was happening, made some very bad decisions, needed to undergo purification before he could rejoin human society. And, you know, there's a lot of trauma in the community, you know, and this particular purification ritual, the whole thing is it doesn't distinguish between what you've done that you need to beg forgiveness for the gods for and what has been done to you that you feel is somehow your fault, or that, you know, it wasn't your fault, but like you still feel stained. So it was, we made a prop well where you could wash your hands. And there was honey and olive leaves. And we had blacklight pens that people could use to write down what it was they needed to be purified of, but so that nobody could see it when they put it in a communal pot that we then took, you know, because it was a hotel conference, outside to the fire pit to burn.
That's awesome.
And like there was an invocation of the Furies at the end, and it was a... It was real good. It was big. It was moving. People loved it. The following year, what we did we only got to trial run it, which infinite thanks to Emily, who was then running the Kansas City Witches Meetup and let us trial run our big festival ritual, where everybody embodied Prometheus and broke their chains and beat the Eagle of Zeus to death. We actually made an Eagle of Zeus pinata.
Fuck yeah.
And an enormous arrow prop. Fuck yeah. And everybody got to take a swing at the Eagle of Zeus pinata.
I have goosebumps. I fucking love it. That's awesome.
No, we were so, and we desperately needed this, right? Because like in our, there were such, we invoked Prometheus every year of the festival we got chased out of. And so like, we were feeling very chained to the mountain, and we had to have a ritual about that.
Hmm.
But and you know that, you know, then lockdowns happened and Paganicon didn't happen in 2020, and then we just never managed to make it back. And you know, maybe, you know, the world is enough changed that ritual doesn't feel like it's exactly what anybody else needs anymore, but we got to do it for us. That's the Kansas City Sorcerer's Arts Collective. We do big crazy rituals, like based on real specific myths, real specific images. We've taught classes on tarot, sigils, energy work, spirit conjuration, ritual etiquette, ritual construction, a few other things. And we are, yeah, like I said, we kind of collapsed in the middle of 2020 because burnout and depression and technical difficulties. But we're winding back up. We're currently researching venues and brainstorming projects. And I don't know whether I want to talk about any specific plans that we have just because they're so embryonic, but yeah, we're trying to wind back up because we miss doing public ritual.
So if there's folks who are listening that are kind of in the area that are curious about like maybe getting involved, is there a way for them to do that, or is this kind of just a rebuilding phase of things?
Right now we're still very much at the rebuilding stage. The long-term plan does involve it being a kind of umbrella group where people who share our vision and ethics can join to do that work. But right now we're kind of we're still kind of winding back up, and we're definitely not ready for that yet.
Okay, very cool. Well, yeah, if you guys are going to be, you know, performing or doing some stuff that you want to let the listeners know about, just let me know and we can do that, because that sounds cool.
I will do. I super appreciate cool. that.
So I'm kind of curious, if you don't mind me picking your brain a little bit about this. I think that the topic of, you know, public ritual and public performance is on the mind of a lot of my friends, you know, after Babylon Rising and, you know, seeing so many like cool performances and rituals and everything, and, you know, having the honor of giving, you know, a couple of my own and everything. Like, I think that it's something that a lot of folks is on a lot of folks' mind. And so if you wouldn't mind sharing a couple of tips or ideas that you might have picked up from doing this type of work that people who are approaching it from a more solitary practice might find handy.
I think the number one tip for making that jump is to understand from the outset that what works for you in your personal circle, or even like you and your coven, is not necessarily going to scale up to 50 or 100 or 200. So like when you make the decision to go public, have the venue in mind, have the physical space of the venue in mind. When we were doing our work with the now defunct Heartland Pagan Festival, by tradition as old as the festival, the main rituals were held in the same space as the main fire, which was cool because it was kind of central to where everybody was, but it was a problem because the fire pit, you know, the fire crew had already built the 10-foot tall stack of firewood that was going to be that night's bonfire. And, you know, fucking try shouting at 200 people through that pile of wood.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so like, and also it was a field. So like, unless you'd had like at least a modicum of vocal training, being heard by anyone, let alone everyone, was a problem. And so we had to design our rituals around those limitations. Conversely, when we were doing the hotel, we had to design rituals where you couldn't burn anything, not candles, not incense, nothing. Mm-hmm. And it all had to pack up and pack out like 5 minutes before and 5 minutes after. And we had a big enough ritual crew that we did a lot with that. And I guess the number one thing, and this is going to vary a lot with your individual, the individual culture of where you're at. Are you performing a ritual for people or with people? At Heartland, the longstanding tradition was that the ritual was a theatrical performance with minimal engagement from the attendees. There, you know, not everyone before us had done it that way, but the majority of the people. And so it was an uphill battle to get people like in the circle, chanting with us, dancing with us, visualizing, mm-hmm. Calling out, you know. And one of the things we learned in the process of doing it all is how do you make things accessible? out at camp, you had to presume a certain level of mobility, but also there was like you had to have places for people to sit because not everybody could stand the whole time, mm-hmm. and the seating was a little iffy. In you know, today's world, rituals where you touch strangers are just like absolutely out.
Sure, yeah, where everybody hugs the person next to them. Yeah, I don't think that flies anymore.
From the late 90s, yeah. Where you were, like, supposed to, like, breathe in people's faces and, like... Oh, my God. What were we thinking? Just know what you want to do. The more specific your vision is, the better the ritual is going to be. I think that we worked wonders working within a vaguely eclectic Wiccan framework, but like going forward, we just always dug down more specific than that. And like, we got a lot of people who, cause we did surveys after our Heartland rituals, people were always like, can you do something that's more insert tradition here. And we were like, no, we're not a member of that tradition. If you are, please come join us.
Yeah, it sounds like you're volunteering.
Because we didn't want to do like some half-assed Wikipedia researched bullshit that would land flat because it wasn't our area of expertise.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're building rituals around, like, you know, visions y'all have had, and I mean, like, that's different than, like, someone's like, oh, could you do a Norse ritual or something, you know? Like, that's, yeah, completely different.
Yeah, so, yeah, have a specific vision, tailor that vision as much as possible to the physical and cultural environments that you're going to, make it, really think ahead about how you're going to make this accessible, you know, particularly now that we have endured 3 years of a mass disabling event. A lot of people aren't going to stand and dance like they used to. And it's not just that the community is aging, which it is, and that needs to be taken into account too. But a lot of people's lungs and hearts are just not going to be the same as they were before. Yeah. So you do all your planning, you have your idea, you execute your ritual. It's going to fall flat for some people. Listen to them. Apologize if they say they were hurt, even if you think they're being disingenuous, and do better next time, because you're not going to get it perfect anytime, let alone the first time.
Fuck yeah, this is really good advice. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Just every time you go out in public, try to do a little bit better. Whatever didn't work, take the lessons from that. If you have met friends and mentors who've done public ritual, talk to them, but you know, take their feedback. If you have experts in a field, We had the advantage of working with a woman who was the ASL translator for the festival for as long as I'd been going, and a close personal friend of mine who also did various other disability advocacy. And when we invited her to join the crew, that meant listening to her when she told us that what we were doing was fucked up and not going to work for people. And some of those conversations were awkward. Some of the times our feelings were hurt. We worked through it, and we made shit better.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. There's a line from this show, Adventure Time, that I really like, which is like, sucking at something is the first step to being kind of good at it.
I never got into the show, but that is one of the truest things anybody has said about anything, but particularly art and magic.
Absolutely. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me this evening. Is there anything that, I know there was some other stuff that we were going to talk about, but this has been fantastic. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you wanted to discuss though?
No, this is everything I wanted to talk about, really. I'm really grateful to have you on here, or to you to have me on here, if I can get the order of the words correct. I've had a really good time telling stories and talking about art and magic.
Hell yeah, I appreciate it. Is there any questions that you would like to ask me?
So I've mentioned that the festival I used to attend is now defunct. I'm in search of a new home festival. Are you ready to tell stories about Babylon Rising yet?
Sure, I can tell a little bit about Babylon Rising. What would you like me to tell? Yeah,
I guess the thing that I'm most curious about it is how well they welcome people when you roll up onto that isolated land. How much help do you get orienting yourself to where you camp, where you park? What's the local culture?
So the actual land itself is owned by the people that put on the event. So the local culture, like in southern Indiana, is much different than the event culture. There, you'll notice if you go, there's kind of a little bit of a difference there for sure. Yeah. But this was my first time at the event, and my first time in the area. So yeah, I rolled in there with my friend and my partner, and we were welcomed at the gate and, you know, shown where to go, and yeah, basically a hand held until we were, you know, found our campsite and everything. And it was incredibly chill and welcoming. It was very, very inclusive. As far as my experiences went, I didn't hear about anybody having bad experiences this year at all. So I think a lot of people felt that way as well. And I was really impressed with, honestly, how overall chill it was. It was very, very cool.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. I'll have to check it out some year.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely would recommend. Yeah, it was a
I'm still kind of processing. It was definitely a new experience to, you know, perform in that way. I performed sex magic for the first time in like a more kind of public venue than I ever have. And that was an interesting experience. My friend Joy and I did a ritual where we, in tandem, performed the headless rite together.
Oh, interesting.
And it was fucking really, really rad. It went over pretty well. People seemed to be very into it. And so, yeah, that was dope. And yeah, I was able to participate in one of my friend's rituals, which was very fun. I got to dance for it. And so, yeah, it was just really cool to be able to step out of my comfort zone in a place that felt so chill and inclusive and everything. So, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yes. Yes, definitely would recommend to people who feel called to do such things. Well, Jeffrey, where can people find your work?
I'm kind of all over the place on the internet. I've got the blog, journeythroughtheobsidiandream.com. I've got the jewelry store, sorcererswork.etsy.com. And I've got an Instagram and a Twitter and a Facebook to promote all of it. And you can find all of those things in one place at my main website, jsgroves.com. You can also find links to my novels there and my photography and just all of the insane number of things that I do. There's links to all of it at jsgroves.com.
All right. Hell yeah. Well, maybe sometime if you would be into it, you wouldn't mind coming back and we could talk about, you know, narrative and magic and maybe get into some more classic stuff.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me this evening.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Man getting bit by an alligator screams.
Alright, fuck yeah, thanks so much to Jeffrey. Check out the main site, jsgroves.com, to find all of the very cool work that was mentioned here today, and a lot of stuff that wasn't. There's all kinds of cool shit. You can see pics of the talismanic jewelry that Jeffrey makes on Instagram at Sorcerer's Workbench. It's a very dope aesthetic. I really enjoyed the conversation, and as I said, appreciated Jeffrey's advice about doing public ritual. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I recently had the opportunity to make use of some of this advice while doing some protection work here locally. No plan survives first contact, so having contingencies and flexibilities is of course key. Keeping this in mind allowed me to make some last-minute adjustments to the ritual I ran in order to like cope with shifting circumstances, and things went off really well. And if anybody is listening from the shed, I just want to say thank you so much for giving me the space in which to do that work. It really meant a lot to me, and I appreciate being able to do my weird woo-woo shit in an attempt to confront some of what's happening here politically, or maybe just to cope with it emotionally. Take your pick. We're going to hear some of your fantastic poetry from the online crypto poetry contest, as well as an update about the Green Mushroom Project and some final thoughts, but before we do, let me remind you to check out all of the great shows on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. We've got Administrism, Grognostics, Primordia, XV Planis, Ad Hoc History, and Smuts Up. If you like the show and you're into what we've got going on here, please consider supporting it on Patreon. There are some costs associated with producing a podcast, in addition to the considerable time that it takes, so your support helps me to justify doing this to myself. Thank you so much to the people who are making the show possible by giving on Patreon or Buy Me a Coffee, and to the people who are supporting the show by spreading the word. Helping people who might be interested in all of this stuff find the show is a great way to show your support if money is tight. Tell your friends and your sous chef about the show. Tell your bishop and your mistress, your sandwich artist, about it too. Tell your siblings and your cousins and that person who no one likes to admit is part of the family about it as well. You can also post about it on social media or write a positive review where that's a thing, which I think is most places now. Seriously, getting the word out about the show is super helpful, as is helping to curtail costs. So thank you so much to those of you who are already doing that. I really appreciate it.
And yes, don't forget to smash the fucking shit out of that follow button so you can get updates about when a new episode comes out. You can find Lux Occult, Hello Void, and other merch available at illuminindustries.com, which is my Etsy store. Items will be printed on demand using the most eco-friendly options I could find and shipped directly to you at pretty close to cost. And there's some fun stuff in there. Winners of the Crypto Poetry Contest will receive cool prizes from there and more. Speaking of which, let's do listener mail, which today will be featuring your poetry. Fucking stoked to share it. All right, so my plan is to read all of the poems you sent in so far on the show, and the winners will be read again when they are announced. All right, this first one was sent in by Sheila. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. Ink trails fade behind. Temperamental journey. Occulted garden. All right, very evocative. I love it. Fuck yeah. This next one is from Onryopticon. It's called Paletropos. More deft than bones permit to twist and curl and grip. No limits to their turning. No gyre binds them. Curious and clutching, exploring, curious, to take and offer and strike, to embrace, jealously hold, the arm, the leg, the nimble hand, the tongue, the teeth, seeking mouth, all powers granted to the hungry limbs. All right, very spicy, thank you. We will do more crypto poetry next time, as well as some additional listener mail. Shout out, though, to Rob Jesse on Instagram. I appreciate the kind words. Keep on rockin', fuck yeah. I also wanted to give a shout out to Relics on Instagram, who conducted some great analysis on the image and came up with a lot of really cool shit. I'm not sure if you sent in a poem yet, but there's still time. Shout out to everybody who has participated in the contest. I really wasn't sure if anybody would be, like, into it. But I'm really happy to know that there are other weirdos out there like me who enjoy that type of stuff. Cheers. Stay weird. If you'd like to write some poetry in the vein of what you heard today, don't be shy. Check out the Lux Occult Instagram feed for a picture of me with an octopus plushie, which is the image connected with the contest and has details about how to submit entries. We'll be playing until the end of August, so there's still a little bit of time if you're listening to this episode close to when it came out. If you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, or arcane revelations that you would like to share for listener mail, or if you're a philosophy professor or like power nerd or whatever and feel like it would be enjoyable to discuss Spinoza and his machines and stuff like that, let me know. If you have thoughts about this stuff that you would like to share, you can do so at LuxOccultPod on Instagram or at LuxOccultPod@gmail.com. All right, time for an update about the Green Mushroom Project, which is a large-scale group working that you can be a part of. Check out greenmushroomproject.com for more details about that. And as you heard earlier in the little spot, there is also a Discord server where we organize and hang out. So we have a lot of different irons in the fire right now. There's the 23 Bibliomancy experiment, which continues on as we discover our scripture. There's also a big thing that we're putting together, which we will present once it is all spiffied up and ready. Thanks so much to Dave, Shane, Laughing Dog, Lavender, Charlie, and all of the beta readers who are helping out with that. Thanks also to the fungi who are stepping forward into leadership roles and helping to keep stuff chill and balanced. My background is not in managing people or projects or anything. I have a degree in biology with a focus in environmental science, and before that I worked on cars, so much of what I'm doing these days comes down to figuring it out as I go along. But luckily for me and the project, I'm surrounded by smart, talented, and kind people who are willing to lend me their advice and expertise and share their ideas, and in many cases to very generously bring what they've learned or what they enjoy in their practices to share with the group. I'm really, really grateful for that and for all of you. I'm so excited to see where things go as we continue to learn and grow together. Much love and much love to everyone participating in the project, regardless of what that looks like for you in your practice. Okay, so here are some closing thoughts. Please take them with salt. I'm not a mental health professional or social worker or anything like that. I'm an individual trying to parse out some complex stuff about power dynamics in this crazy world that we live in. This might get a little bit heavy. I'm going to talk about abuse, which in all of its forms comes down to abuse of power. And hopefully this is not too overwhelming after what has been a very full and I think very fun episode. This does actually relate to some of what we talked about today though, so hopefully the logical cogency of this little episode endeavor will remain intact. I've been thinking a lot about the concept of the Eyes of Dionysus that Jeffrey mentioned, and the idea that possession and madness might be catching or contagious. In the case of a Dionysiac, one might become similarly possessed by the god through eye contact. So I have this art project on Instagram called The Mimetic Disease. It's like its own account, which I started a few years ago, when I was deeply obsessed with the notion that mental illness spreads like any other type of illness. In the case of mental illness, through exposure to abuse from people suffering from mental illness. So I've revised my thinking on all of this lately after coming across some new evidence which illustrates that it's probably not like that exactly. The people who behave in abusive ways don't always or even typically do so as a result of mental illness or trauma, even though that's sometimes an excuse that is used. But anyway, the evidence just doesn't like back that up, as it turns out. Nice notion, though it may be. See, actually, as it happens, it's that the abusive person is gaining some kind of benefit from acting in this manner, receiving positive reinforcement for their actions in some way. Further, abusive people typically feel that the way that they are acting is how they should behave. It's their right. They feel entitled, right? It's because of who they are. That's the mindset. So here's an example. If I take your ice cream cone and I push you down on the ground, now I have tasty ice cream. If you decide to just let it go because you're afraid or you're not like in the mood, or maybe you don't even want ice cream right now or whatever, this tells me that I can do it again, no problem. Also, in the future, if I walked up to you, you might just give me your ice cream without me having to do anything. And I've now been taught that this is just how things are. Maybe even that that's how they're supposed to be. Because for the time being, I mean, to some extent, that's kind of true. And until there's no longer a net benefit to me doing so, or I'm challenged or whatever, I'm just going to keep on taking your tasty, tasty ice cream. Okay, so according to the research I've encountered, it's extremely rare for an abuser to actually admit that anything they did was wrong, sometimes even to themselves. It's a really gross and deeply entrenched problem that our species seems to have. The scenarios which were laid out in the research I was reading had to do with abuse as it happens from person to person, most often in romantic relationships. But conceptually, because we're talking about abuse of power, I believe that this can iterate up across other scales. So what's true for abusive people might also be true for abusive institutions. Well, if people are receiving positive reinforcement for acting like abusive assholes, we're going to get more abusive assholes, right? It kind of makes sense, right? Everything's a feedback loop. So what are some ways that we can stop providing positive reinforcement to people who act abusively? There's the whole like Me Too movement, and what people sometimes call cancel culture, which takes away the positive reinforcement of people being accepted as public figures in our culture. But what are some things that we can do in our own lives, though? You know, as individuals, I don't really have any answers to this question. This is more of a rhetorical question to think about. But in the last episode, I talked about the idea from the Bible of like turning the other cheek being more of a challenge and demand for equal treatment in some ways of looking at it, than instruction to submit to abuse. So if you feel you're turning the other cheek right now, in what sense is that playing out for you? How can that be shifted into a way which better respects one's own dignity or sovereignty or humanity? It's worth considering and worth it. Remember to resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Jeffrey Groves and Art Worldbuilding from the Great Game Podcast for joining me and for the awesome conversations. Don't forget to check out both of their awesome work. Thanks to Cecil and Darcy for allowing me to get down with some protection shit. Much obliged, thank you. Thanks to the Mushroom Crew for being really amazing people to work and socialize with. I'm so honored. And most of all, Thanks so much to you for listening. Much love. This is Lux Estrada, reminding you to stay strong and stay fucking curious.
Luxicult is part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Frater Yarmurud.
And I'm Zarina.
And we'd like to introduce you to administrism.
What is administrism?
As an occultist, for years I felt the universe directing me towards a practice that was ecologically based with a foundation laid out by cultures untouched by the influence of what's become modern Western society. With labels like shamanism and neo-shamanism carrying too much uncomfortable post-colonial baggage, I've decided to take my own approach.
Join Yara and me as we research and develop a magical system where we recognize our place in nature with all the life that surrounds us. We want to share with you our journey into a paradigm that incorporates ritual and ecology, anthropology and metaphysics, biology, and the occult.
Using ethically sourced material, historical accounts, ethnographic records, and our own personal experience, we want to share our discoveries as we watch administrism grow in an organic blend of traditional spirituality, modern science, and a dash of homesteading, without all the connotations associated with labels like shamanism.
We hope that by listening to how administrism sprouts in us, it will plant its seeds into your own practice. This way, you can find your own balance between magic and nature.
Because the world needs room for both.
And don't forget, you can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Epic history.
The Greeks are like on the beach, they're like doing burpees or something. The Persians sail up, and they've got little spears and pomegranates and stuff, and they're like, hey, want to be part of our cool empire?
In-depth commentary.
Cutting edge expert drunken analysis. Two people that you don't know anything about.
It's ad hoc history with Asher and Luxa, siblings extraordinaire.
Hey, just real quick, like, if you were emperor, would you choose me as second emperor?
Next question.
Learning.
It's not pretty. It's not nice. And if you want to talk about justification for war and all these things, but when you get to how the sausage is actually made, this is it.
It's ad hoc history.
It's not the history podcast you wanted. It's the history podcast you deserve.